When Mark Zuckerberg revealed that The Analects of Confucius was one of his favorite books, many were surprised. How could a 2,500-year-old text of fragmented conversations resonate with the founder of Facebook? Yet this ancient collection of dialogues has influenced billions of people across centuries, shaping the ethical foundations of East Asian societies and increasingly captivating Western audiences seeking wisdom beyond their own traditions. The Analects presents not a systematic philosophy, but something more intimate, the voice of a remarkable teacher who, through brief exchanges with disciples and rulers, illuminates a path toward becoming more fully human. "Do not impose on others what you yourself do not want," Confucius teaches, a golden rule that transcends time and culture. As we navigate our complex modern world with its technological distractions and ethical challenges, Confucius offers something rare: practical wisdom for cultivating virtue in everyday life, balancing self-improvement with social responsibility, and finding harmony in a world that often feels chaotic. Born in 551 BCE, during the declining years of the Zhao dynasty, Confucius, Kongqu, emerged from modest circumstances to become China's most influential teacher. His life unfolded against a backdrop of political fragmentation, as the once mighty Zhao royal house lost control over increasingly independent regional states. The enforcement system that had maintained social order was collapsing, with aristocrats competing with rulers for wealth and power. In this tumultuous environment, Confucius rose from humble origins, working initially in menial tasks for aristocratic families before ascending to government positions in his native state of Lu. As Minister of Works and later Minister of Crime, he demonstrated exceptional administrative abilities. However, his principled approach to governance eventually clashed with the self-interested politics of Lu's ruling elite. After falling out with Lu's ruler, Confucius embarked on a 14-year period of self-exile, wandering between states with a small group of loyal disciples. This journey, though politically disappointing, proved intellectually fertile. The conversations that took place during these travels formed the foundation of his teaching legacy. Throughout his wanderings, Confucius sought a ruler who would implement his vision of virtuous government. He believed that the moral resolve of a few could favorably affect the fate of many, but insisted that good men must test their principles in the arena of politics rather than retreat into private virtue. His political ideal was grounded in the example of the Duke of Zhao, who had established a system based on trust and mutual obligations with minimal legal constraints. Confucius attracted disciples from diverse backgrounds: aristocrats' sons, common gentlemen, merchants, farmers, and even the sons of criminals. They sought not just practical skills for official careers, but a gentleman's refinement and moral acuity. Three disciples stand out in the Analects: the resourceful Zigong, the brave but impetuous Zilu, and the morally exemplary Yan Hui, who accompanied him during his 14-year journey. Returning to Lu at nearly 70, Confucius lived his final years as a respected elder statesman. Though comfortable, he remained reflective, weighing opposing views of history and human character with greater precision while speaking more frankly about his defeats and fatigue. Near life's end, he told his disciple Zigong that he intended to remain silent, adding, "What does heaven ever say? Yet the four seasons move in order and the hundred things come to life." He died at 72, leaving behind a legacy that would transform Chinese civilization. The Analects stands as China's most important book, though its significance isn't immediately obvious. Unlike systematic philosophical treatises, it captures what Confucius said in response to specific situations, compiled by generations of disciples after his death. Its authority emerged gradually through competitive interpretations, with followers like Mencius and Sunzi expanding his ideas to address changing social complexities. The text's influence grew dramatically when imperial patronage during the Han Dynasty embedded Confucian principles into China's institutions. Despite a 7th-century decline when Buddhism flourished, Confucianism experienced a powerful revival during the Song Dynasty, addressing everything from metaphysics to governance. When Mongol rulers later limited civil service examinations to 4 Confucian texts, including the Analects, the book became essential study for anyone seeking social advancement through government service. What makes the Analects endure is not just its wisdom, but its ambiguity. The text allows Confucius to emerge not as an elevated idea, but as a thinking, speaking human aware of his limitations. More importantly, engaging with the Analects deepens our connection to our own lives, family, friends, students, country, politics, and memories. Though challenging to approach due to its fragmentary nature and abundance of unexplained names, the text rewards persistent readers. As Cheng Yao Tian said of literature, it takes us by the hand and bolsters us up. It holds us by the arm to get us on our way. The Analects guides us through life's complexities not by providing absolute answers, but by modeling a way of thinking that balances competing values, tradition with innovation, self-cultivation with social responsibility, moral idealism with practical governance. At the heart of Confucius's teaching lies a profound commitment to self-cultivation. The way of the gentleman, he teaches, consists of 3 things. The humane never suffer from vexation, the wise are never perplexed, the brave are never afraid. This ideal represents the culmination of a lifelong journey of learning and moral development. Confucius believed this journey begins with rigorous study of the cultural tradition, particularly poetry and ritual. He valued the odes for giving the spirit an exhortation and the mind keener eyes, making one better adjusted in a group and more articulate when voicing a complaint. Knowledge, however, required application. A person may be able to recite 300 poems, but if unable to put this knowledge to use when given a political assignment or diplomatic mission, what good will it do? Similarly, with ritual practice, Confucius told his son, "Unless you learn the rites, you won't be able to find your balance." True ritual must transform one inwardly, not merely create an impressive exterior, which would be like a thief who makes his way into a house by boring a hole through the wall. When Yan Hui asked about humaneness, Ren, the core virtue in Confucian ethics, Confucius replied, "Restrain the self and return to the rites. This is the way to be humane." He emphasized that humaneness comes from within, not from others, and requires daily discipline. Do not look at, listen to, speak of, or act in ways contrary to ritual propriety. Confucius taught that humaneness is immediately accessible. Is humaneness far away? As soon as I desire humaneness, it is here. Yet, he lamented, I have never met a person who loved virtue as much as physical beauty. This captures the paradox that moral life is always available by choice, yet people often resist putting effort into it or find immoral paths more alluring. The gentleman, according to Confucius, broadens his learning through literature while restraining himself through ritual practice. Literature preserves the teachings of sages and the moral way, while ritual practice tests and manifests this knowledge in daily life. This balance between intellectual expansion and ethical restraint creates a character that is gentle but serious and principled, dignified but not fierce, respectful but relaxed. Confucius emphasized that true learning transforms the whole person. The gentleman makes demands on himself. The petty man makes demands on others. While petty men focus on external validation and material gain, the gentleman concentrates on self-improvement rather than finding fault in others. As Confucius advised, do not worry that other people do not know you. Be concerned that you do not know them. Confucius's teachings on human relationships reveal a sophisticated understanding of social dynamics. At their foundation lies the principle of reciprocity, Shu. Do not impose on others what you yourself do not want. This golden rule appears deceptively simple, but contains profound implications for how we interact with others. For Confucius, proper relationships begin with family. When asked about filial piety, he emphasized that maintaining a proper facial expression is the most difficult aspect, more challenging than performing physical duties or serving elders first at meals. This suggests that true filial piety involves genuine emotional engagement rather than mere outward compliance. Beyond family, Confucius offered nuanced guidance on friendship. He advised, "Be honest when there is a reason to reprove a friend and guide him with a deft hand. But if he is unwilling to listen, you should stop, because you don't want to be humiliated." He distinguished between beneficial and harmful friendships. Beneficial friends are upright, trustworthy, and learned, offering honest guidance and wisdom. Harmful friends display practiced manners, affected sweetness, and glib tongues, appearing pleasant but ultimately misleading. In professional relationships, Confucius emphasized integrity and appropriate boundaries. He warned against working with petty fellows, noting they worry about getting positions before obtaining them, then fear losing them afterward, and will do anything to hold on to them. Unlike gentlemen who focus on fulfilling responsibilities, petty fellows lack the courage to speak candidly to their superiors. Confucius recognized the challenges of managing different types of relationships. He observed that women and servants are difficult to manage. They become insolent if treated too familiarly, but complain if kept at a distance. While this statement has been criticized as misogynistic, it likely reflects his awareness of the complex dynamics that emerge when people occupy subordinate positions in hierarchical societies. Perhaps most importantly, Confucius taught that true relationships require genuine presence. When Zigong asked if a single word could guide one's life, Confucius offered Shu, reciprocity, the capacity to understand others by reference to oneself. This empathetic understanding forms the foundation of Confucian ethics, allowing us to treat others with the same consideration we desire for ourselves. Confucius's political thinking balances pragmatism with moral purpose. In Book 13, he addresses governance principles, stating that rectifying names must come first, restoring integrity to language so people can trust what's said. Without this foundation, punishments become arbitrary and government fails. When Ji Kongxi asked about governance, Confucius replied with a wordplay. To govern, zeng, is to correct, zeng. When you set an example by correcting your mistakes, who will dare not to correct his mistakes? This reflects his belief that self-correction is key to both personal character development and effective government. Confucius emphasized that moral example, not force, is the true basis of authority. The character of those at the top is like wind. The character of those below is like grass. When wind blows over grass, the grass is sure to bend. When asked about killing those who don't follow the moral way, he rejected this approach, placing responsibility on the ruler's cultivation and conduct. While holding firm to principles, Confucius allowed flexibility in practice. He advised officials to overlook minor shortcomings, promote talent, and prioritize making people rich before instructing them. When visiting Wei, he noted its large population and advised first making them wealthy, then providing moral instruction. This reflects the Confucian principle that material security must precede moral education. Confucius identified three essentials of governance: sufficient food, a well-equipped army, and the trust of the common people. Asked which to abandon first if necessary, he chose the army, then food, explaining, "Death has been the human lot since the beginning of time, but a state cannot survive if it does not have the trust of the common people." He warned against self-interested governance, stating that when actions are motivated solely by profit, one incurs much unhappiness. This principle applies especially to rulers, where profit-driven governance creates disorder and hostility among the people. Confucius claimed he could bring governance to an acceptable condition within a year and show real accomplishments after 3 years. However, he recognized that even a true king would need a full generation, 30 years, before humaneness could prevail. This patient approach to political reform reflects his understanding that lasting change requires both material prosperity and moral transformation. Throughout the Analects, Confucius contrasts the gentleman, Junzi, with the petty person, Shaorin, creating a powerful framework for understanding human character. These terms originally referred to social status, gentleman indicating aristocratic birth and petty person denoting common people. However, Confucius transformed them into moral categories, recognizing that petty men could exist among elites and gentlemen among commoners. The gentleman is fair-minded and generous, Confucius explains, while the petty man is partisan and divisive. This fundamental distinction reveals their different orientations. The gentleman seeks common ground and broader perspectives, while the petty person pursues narrow self-interest. Confucius further distinguishes, the gentleman understands what is morally right, the petty man understands what is profitable. While the gentleman prioritizes ethical principles, the petty person focuses on material gain. This doesn't mean the gentleman ignores practical matters, but rather that profit never becomes his primary motivation. Their approaches to self-improvement also differ dramatically. The gentleman makes demands on himself. The petty man makes demands on others. Where the gentleman focuses on self-cultivation and personal responsibility, the petty person blames external factors for their shortcomings. Even their mistakes reveal their character. The gentleman tends to err toward excessive generosity, while the petty man errs toward meanness. Their emotional lives contrast sharply as well. The gentleman is large of spirit and mind, while the petty man is always nervous about something. Having done all he can, the gentleman faces the unknown with ease, while the petty man, lacking moral anchor, frets constantly. In relationships, the gentleman is easy to serve but difficult to please. He won't be satisfied by improper means but employs others according to their capacities. The petty man is difficult to serve but easily pleased, accepting impropriety while expecting subordinates to handle everything regardless of ability. Confucius observed, the gentleman harmonizes without being an echo. The petty man echoes and does not harmonize. Like making good soup requires balancing flavors, true harmony comes from integrating different perspectives rather than merely repeating what others say. Perhaps most tellingly, the gentleman has breadth of character but is not arrogant. The petty man is arrogant but has no breadth of character. This reveals the paradox that true greatness brings humility, while limited understanding often produces inflated self-importance. For Confucius, learning was not merely academic study, but a lifelong journey of moral and intellectual development. I am not one who was born with knowledge, he admitted. I am one who loves antiquity and is diligent in seeking it. This humble approach to knowledge characterized his entire life. Confucius described his own learning process. At 15, I set my heart on learning. At 30, I took my stand. At 40, I had no doubts. At 50, I knew the mandate of heaven. At 60, my ear was attuned. At 70, I could follow my heart's desire without overstepping the boundaries. This progression reveals learning as a gradual unfolding of understanding that integrates knowledge with character. He emphasized that learning requires active engagement. I will not open the door for a mind that is not already striving to understand, nor will I provide words to a tongue that is not already struggling to speak. After showing one corner of a square, if a student couldn't find the other three, he wouldn't repeat himself. While requiring little payment, accepting even modest gifts like dried meat from new students, Confucius expected students to struggle with learning and seek understanding independently. Confucius warned against learning without reflection. Learning without thinking leads to confusion. Thinking without learning leads to danger. True understanding requires both acquiring knowledge and processing it through careful consideration. As he told Zigong, I bind it together into a single thread. integrating disparate learning into coherent wisdom. His approach to teaching was personalized. There are those who act without knowing why. I do not act that way. Listen widely, select what is good, and follow it. Observe broadly and become aware of patterns. This is the second best kind of knowledge. He recognized that while innate wisdom is ideal, most people must cultivate understanding through diligent study and observation. Confucius ranked people by their relationship to knowledge. Those born with it stand at the top, followed by those who acquire it through learning, then those who struggle but persist in learning, and finally, those who struggle and don't even try. Despite acknowledging innate differences in intelligence, he maintained that persistent effort enables nearly anyone to attain knowledge. His advice for learning was practical. Set your aim for the way, hold on to your integrity, rely on your humanity, and get your share of play in the arts. This balanced approach combines moral purpose with intellectual enjoyment, creating a sustainable path for lifelong development. For Confucius, ritual, li, and music were not mere formalities but powerful tools for cultivating both individual character and social harmony. Unless you learn the rites, he told his son, you won't be able to find your balance. Ritual provides structure and boundaries that help people navigate complex social relationships. Confucius emphasized that ritual must be internalized rather than mechanically performed. When Zai Wo questioned the 3-year mourning period, arguing a year was sufficient, Confucius explained that this practice reflects the deep bond between parents and children. The ritual period allows for proper processing of grief while honoring the relationship that formed one's very existence. He warned against empty formalism, asking rhetorically whether rites merely referred to jade and silk or music to bells and drums. The true value of rituals lies not in their material implements, but in their ability to transform the practitioner and bring order to society. As Yuzi noted, harmony is the most prized element in ritual practice, making the way of former kings beautiful in matters both large and small. Music held special significance for Confucius. After hearing the Shao music in Qi, he didn't notice the taste of meat for 3 months, exclaiming he never imagined music could be so beautiful. The Shao, associated with sage Emperor Shun, embodied the peace of political order through its harmonious tones. Confucius described proper music as beginning with vigorous playing, and when in full swing becoming pure and harmonious, with notes that are bright and distinct, and passages that are fluent and continuous until the music reaches the end. This musical progression mirrors the development of character, beginning with energy, finding balance, achieving clarity, and maintaining consistency. He contrasted the Shao music of Emperor Shun as perfectly beautiful and perfectly good with King Wu's music as perfectly beautiful but not perfectly good because it celebrated a violent conquest. This distinction reveals Confucius's belief that aesthetic beauty should align with moral goodness. Confucius outlined a progression in learning. The odes are to stimulate our mind and spirit. The rites are to steady us. Music is the final lesson. This sequence suggests either his teaching methodology or an analogy for self-cultivation, from inspiration to balance to harmonious integration. By balancing ritual restraint with musical expression, Confucius offered a path to personal and social harmony. Ritual without music becomes rigid formalism. Music without ritual becomes unstructured emotion. Together, they create a balanced character capable of both discipline and spontaneity, respect and joy. Despite the vast distance of time and culture separating us from Confucius, his teachings remain remarkably relevant to contemporary life. In our age of political polarization, his emphasis on rectifying names reminds us that honest communication requires shared understanding of basic terms. When words lose their integrity, social trust erodes and governance becomes impossible. In our individualistic society, Confucius offers a compelling vision of the self as fundamentally relational. The gentleman helps others to realize what is good in them, he teaches. He does not help others to realize what is reprehensible about them. This approach to relationships, focusing on nurturing others' potential rather than criticizing their flaws, provides an antidote to today's culture of judgment and division. For those navigating professional ethics, Confucius provides timeless guidance. When actions are motivated solely by profit, one incurs much unhappiness. His insistence that we consider the moral implications of our work challenges the modern separation between business decisions and ethical concerns. Similarly, his observation that an upright person need not give orders to get things done, while one who lacks integrity will not be obeyed despite issuing commands, speaks directly to contemporary leadership challenges. In our digital age of instant opinions, Confucius warns against those who hear something on the road and immediately launch into a disquisition, calling this forsaking virtue. His emphasis on careful reflection before speaking offers a corrective to social media's encouragement of reactive commentary. For parents and educators, Confucius models a balanced approach to teaching that respects individual differences while maintaining high expectations. He recognized that students learn differently, yet insisted that persistent effort enables nearly anyone to attain knowledge. His personalized teaching methods, challenging each student according to their unique temperament, remain a model for effective education. Perhaps most importantly, Confucius offers wisdom for living with uncertainty. When threatened with violence, he remained calm, saying, "With King Wen dead, is it not so that his cultural vestiges are invested in me? If heaven intended this culture to be destroyed, it would not have let descendants take part in it." This quiet confidence in the enduring value of cultural wisdom provides stability in turbulent times. As we face unprecedented global challenges, Confucius reminds us that character matters more than circumstances. "Only in the deepest winter," he observed, "do we realize that the pine and cypress are the last to shed their leaves. Like these evergreens, those with moral integrity reveal their true nature precisely when conditions are most difficult, a timeless lesson for our uncertain age."